Good morning, everybody. Before we start, two things. Our learning should be in the merit of that Rena's daughter is having an interview with a social worker for an adoption of a baby this afternoon, and we just want to daven that that all goes well, and that this baby, if this is the right shidduch, that this is the right place, and we want this to go forward. So, God willing, she needs a grandchild, so we're getting one quick. You know, none of this waiting 9 months thing. Okay, we're getting one quick.
Thank you.
And the other is in the merit of a refuah shlema for the mother and daughter who were the survivors of the fire last Shabbos, who are Tzipora bat Gila and Gila bat Tzipora. So it's, I know it sounds weird, but a mother-daughter name for a grandmother, et cetera. I was trying to figure out, like, wait a minute, how is that possible? I'm sorry, yes.
Unfortunately, Sylvia Singer did pass.
Yes. It should be an aliyah for her neshama. And thank you to those who called. They had an overwhelming response of people who wanted to give white blood cells to her, and it ended up being too late. But the love and the outpouring of affection was very much appreciated by everybody and by her family.
And my safe travels to Morocco and back.
Safe travels to Morocco and back. Okay. And all safe travels everywhere for anybody. It's like nothing is for sure. Okay, we'll start with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'na'atan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein haTorah. This week is another special Shabbos. It is, in addition to being Parshat Tzav, it is also called Shabbat HaGadol, the Great Shabbos. So there will be an additional Torah reading, Haftorah, for Shabbat HaGadol. And actually, is there a special Torah reading for Shabbat HaGadol or just the Haftorah? Okay, just the Haftorah is... Yes, okay. No, it's a special Haftorah, a special Maftir as well. Special second Torah reading as well as a special Haftorah for...
A
tzav? It is, I'm sorry?
A tortoise.
An adulteress, did you say?
A tortoise?
Oh, I don't know. It means command, like mitzvah. It's the command form of mitzvah. Tzav, command. So might be also a tortoise, I don't know.
We'll ask
Gabby. Okay. All right. Ready? Okay. So we're going to talk about Parshat Tzav, but just for one idea, and the rest is going to be about Pesach. Since we will not be meeting next Thursday, I, God willing, will be on my way to New York, and it'll be almost Erev Pesach. So hopefully another opportunity for inspiration. Please go online and go to aish.com. There are little videos, there are writings, there's like a zillion things to inspire and inform people about Pesach. So enjoy. Oh, you're very sweet. That's because I have lots of wonderful things. This will be based on teachings from Rebbetzin Esther Wien and Rabbi Zakatinsky, and something else that I read that I do not remember who I read it from. It was somebody new, but it was on Parshat Tzav. And so we're going to turn just briefly to page 579 within the Parsha. Tzav means command. Uh-huh, that's the opening word of the Parsha, and it means, that's because that's the first word. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe l'amor, Tzav et Aharon, command Aaron. So that's the word Tzav means command. From the word mitzvah. It's the same.
Is it in the land?
I'm sorry?
Just in the land of Israel or everywhere?
No, does the word Tzav mean that everywhere? The word Tzav just means command. And Moshe was told to command Aaron and his sons about the cleaning of the ash from the altar. So that's how the Parsha opens up. But the whole thing is a tzav. The whole thing is a commandment. We're going to focus on one part of a piece that is in here. And if you look on the margin at the top of page 579, on the left-hand side, what does it say?
Where?
In the margin on 579. fat and blood, okay? Like, oh, that sounds so appetizing. Okay, so I read something really interesting. This is at the drush level. So we don't, the fat and the blood, those were offered on the altar. We are not supposed to eat the fat. Now, this doesn't mean that if you have a fatty cholent or a fatty roast, you're not supposed to have fat. There's certain parts of the body of the animal that are the fats where that cover certain parts of the organs that are, we're not eating. I don't know anything about it. I'm sorry? No, 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 no. It has nothing to do with cholesterol. It has to do with what the fat. No. Yeah, because you can eat liver and that's a lot of cholesterol in there, okay? So it has nothing to do with cholesterol. So fat and blood that were not eaten, that were burned on the altar. But this was a really beautiful idea about what fat and blood represent in us. And when we talk about offering something on the altar, that always means dedicating it to God. So dedicating fat and blood, what does that mean? It says that the blood represents our life force. Okay, there are life force, that which goes through our veins, it's running through our veins. And when we talk about something, somebody is passionate about something, we associate blood with passion. Okay, the passion, and you can even associate it with zoresis, with alacrity, and being able to do something is blood, is like the life force. And fat, what is fat? If blood is the life force, what do you think fat is? Bless you. Fat is lethargy. The couch potato part. See, the lack of moving, okay? It's the opposite of blood. But there is something to be said about offering up our fat, offering up our couch potato-ness also to God, says, because sometimes we get it mixed up. Sometimes we have a lot of alacrity to do the wrong thing, and we're the couch potato to do the right thing. It's like, oh, you know, I don't have time, I'm not interested, I'm tired, etc., I can't get off the couch. It says, if we would just reverse it and put the alacrity into the mitzvahs and the couch potato into the averas, into the mistakes, saying, I don't have enough energy to sin, I don't have enough energy to do the wrong thing. So it says, we have to know when to use what. So some people say, oh, I'm just, I procrastinate. It's like, I bet you don't procrastinate on everything, that there are things that when you want something, and it's usually to satisfy a desire, we tend to get ourselves there just lickety-split. You know, those people who wait in line for their concert tickets, their sports game tickets, they're up at the crack of dawn. Those could be the same people who are late to work, you know, who couldn't possibly make a minion at 6:30, but they could be standing in line or even spending the night in line at 6 a.m. So it's like, well, when are we applying the fat and when are we applying the blood? So it says to devote that all to Hashem, that is our goal, is to say everything we have, there's a place for being slow and heavy and reluctant. It'd be best to apply it to when we're about to do something wrong. And there's something to be said about having alacrity, and we certainly don't want to run to go do evil. We want to run to go do a mitzvah. So in this way, we have even just like this little hint of fat and blood, which doesn't sound so great, of how we can dedicate that to our service of Hashem. Say, I want my blood to run in the right direction, and even my couch potato, I want to be hesitant. I always say that is really why I could not be a mastermind criminal, because I have too much fat to go like get the list of the duct tape and the whatever it is, you know, the what ammunition you're going to use. I'm like, oh, I'll get it later, you know, like who has time for that? But like, how do people do that? They have a lot of, you know, they have a lot of stuff motivation. Motivation
and your soul and your goodness is also a good reason.
Thank you. I'm looking at the more basic things. All of us have that. Okay, so that's our tzav. Also, just what's interesting, the second little piece that is in the margin there on 579, where it says the parts and their order. And that was the idea that all of the korbanot, that they had an order to them. So that is a little bit of a hint to us for Pesach, because the whole idea of Pesach is going to be at our Seder, which in the word Seder means order. The idea of bringing order, that everything in the Torah and everything really in Judaism is about things being done in the right order, because God is the master misudar. He is the master orderer, organizer. The things happen in order, that there is a process, and that we're trying to bring that into ourselves. And the more we bring order into our own lives, since that is really, it's considered a spiritual quest, a spiritual goal to bring order into our lives. Some people think, oh, I'm just kind of messy. It's like, well, people can't really get to, we don't get to really get to say that. That may be how we are naturally, but we are supposed to. It's in the Musar movement, bringing order into our lives, in our physical world, in space, in time, in thought, in action, is a spiritual accomplishment. There were yeshivas that focused on bringing order and followed along with cleanliness. That it's not okay. God created order. That was the first thing of creation, was going from chaos to order. And our goal is to, if we are to be B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, and get ourselves so that our will and God's will are aligned, it's not possible to do that through being scattered. It is just not possible, because that's antithetical to how God works in the world. So if we want to be on the same page, it's about being ordered. Now, there's some people who come into this world and they have more a sense of that, and there are other people for whom that is very challenging. But it is, there's some people who come into this world with a bad temper. There's some people who come into this world with all sorts of things, and they don't get to say, oh, that's just how I am, that's just how I am. It's like, that may be how you are, but that's not how you're supposed to end up. So there is work to be done to create order. And Passover and Seder is designed to be a workshop for us on that. So you can go to all different kinds of Seders, and people have all different kinds of Haggadahs, but nobody does it in any other order than the order. Nobody says, I think we're going to do the Afikoman first because, you know, that'll be fun for the kids.
Get it over with.
Get it over with. It's like, you may skip, or you may, and really we shouldn't skip, we should do a little something for each thing, but nobody, like, makes the Ungapach good order out of it, because you can't say have an order that's out of order. That's an oxymoron. So the order is the order, and that's how we go through, and we're trying to create that for ourselves. I think, and this is also an interesting idea that I heard, is that the things in the world and in our own personal world want to be in order. Our papers want to be filed. Our clothes want to be folded and in the drawers. That everything that is created is like this. God created this. So what am I doing? Is a sign of disrespect if it's like on the floor and like and not in its right place? Everything needs to be in its right place. That's the whole thing. The encampment of the Jewish people was in certain order. The things in the temple, everything had to be, and then the Mishkan, everything had to be in a certain place, in a certain order. There was an order to the service. There was an order to the day. Our Siddur is called, we call it a prayer book. That's really not a very good name. It's our order. It's the order of the day. Having an order of how we're doing things is really a spiritual accomplishment, and the more we work on that, the better. Now, this does not mean to be, you know, OCD on this. Okay, this is not, we're not trying to be, you know, oh, you know, the matches have to be like this and they can't be on a slant. We're not talking about that. We're talking about normal order, and that is a really a spiritual accomplishment, and that helps us align our will with God's will. If we look and see what do that, everything that we do has to be, everything has to be done like at a certain time. You don't get to have Shabbos be like some other day, and like it has to come on Shabbos. None of our holidays are ever going to be on the last Monday of the month. They're never going to get switched to that, because it has to be at the right time in the month at the right time. So all those things have to be ordered, because that is the nature of creation. So if we want to align ourselves with that, we're supposed to do that. I have something funny. Actually, I think I brought it with me, because I keep it with me, because I'm challenged by this. I love order, but I have a hard time achieving it. But I have this little cartoon. I may have shared this with you before. I think it's really funny. And I keep it in my calendar. It's a little cartoon. It says, to a couple sitting down, it says, we all know the term feng shui, but why isn't it ever translated into English? And the other person says, who wants to buy a book called Pick Your Junk Up Off the Floor? Isn't that funny? So.
You're so right. And also what I noticed is that I did a big job on my studio, that I can teach 10 times better than having boxes there.
Yeah.
Changes. Less clutter.
Less clutter. We're not supposed to have clutter. And even though they're the magnets that say a messy desk or a clean desk is a sign of a whatever, sick mind or something.
Oh my God.
But it says there's more creativity in order.
That's a bigger house.
Yeah, okay. So then we have to have getting ourselves rid of clutter. Because the other thing that disorder creates is it causes us to waste time, because we can't find our things. Or we buy more things because we didn't think we had it, because we forgot because it was like in the back of the closet stuffed around. I mean, all these things. And time is our most precious commodity. It cannot be replaced. It cannot be restored. And to have things in a way in our environment that causes us to waste time, or to waste other people's time, or to be late because you couldn't find your whatever, the notes for the meeting. It's like, it's not okay. It's not okay. So in the live and let live world, it's like, oh, you just be how you want to be. It's like, that's not our approach. Our approach is, please bring some Seder to our lives and help us do that with ourselves. So that's what we're doing also as we're preparing for Pesach. And just like the Korbanot, also, there was an order. There's an order to everything. Okay, so think about that. Think about that order. I've been thinking about this a lot just as I'm getting ready for Pesach. Like, okay, I'm trying to bring order. Even if you just, like, clean out your purse. Just one more thing as an aside, too. This is interesting. They've done studies that show that people who are kind of emotionally and mentally kind of feeling frazzled, that doing something to organize something helps them. So that even, and specifically they found that organizing linen closets for some reason, I don't know if it's like seeing things folded and everything stacked, like with all the folds on one way, there's something about, okay, this part of my universe is working. And we may wonder why teenagers tend to be very messy. It's really a reflection of what's going on inside of them. And so you see what is actually happening on the inside. Helping them become organized can actually go the other way too and help them be a little bit more in, feeling more managing their life, is bringing the physical world into control and into order. Okay, so we want to be orderers in our world so that we can come in and be in order. Pesach. More Pesach. All right. So I have something to share with you about one of the plagues. So we're actually going to go back for a moment to Parsha Bo. Parsha Bo on page 341. If you remember, we spoke about this a little bit when we were in Parsha Bo, that the plagues are divided into two parshas. The Vayera has seven, and Bo has three. We had a little handy gematria that Bo is equal to three, Bet is equal to two, Aleph is equal to one, so that the gematria of the name of the Parsha Bo is equal to three, to hint at the three plagues that are there. We are going to take a look at a moment, the interesting idea about the plague of locusts, of what it is we are trying to learn from locusts. And so we're going to take a look at verse 4. Verse 4 on page 341.
So and, has 7 and Bo has 3?
Yes. Hazel, would you like to read verse 4?
Sure. Well, if you refuse to send forth my people, behold, tomorrow I shall bring a locust swarm into your border.
Okay. So it sounds normal. It sounds normal. As normal as a plague sounds. That's a normal plague, locust. Okay.
I guess it's kosher.
So some of them, not all of them. Some of them are kosher.
What?
So
the women are kosher.
Some species of locusts are kosher.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah. So some people, all Jews have a thing about bugs. We don't have a thing about bugs. We have things about the bugs that are prohibited. But there are some bugs that are allowed. Okay, but don't go looking for them in the store. You're not going to find them. Okay, so where it says here, tomorrow I shall bring a locust swarm. So in Hebrew, it's machar arbe bigvulecha. Machar meaning tomorrow. Arbe, that's what locust is in Hebrew. Bigvulecha, to your borders. So the word machar says, anytime we see the word machar in this, is a reference to the future, meaning Mashiach. Then when Mashiach comes, there's going to be locusts. It's like, we don't want locusts when Mashiach comes. It says, I'm going to bring not the locusts of actually a plague of locusts, I'm going to bring you the understanding of locusts. So you may not have ever had this on your mind, keeping you up nights, about, so what's so interesting about locusts? It says the locust is a very interesting bug, and it's unique, or creature, in that it has a hard shell, and it has a soft body. However, unlike some other animals which find like a shell or a rock and like grow into it, the locust grows the shell, and then the shell detaches from it, and it lives in its shell. That's really weird. Okay? So that's kind of different. It says, okay, so that's different. So what does that have to do with anything? It says, that is a description of reality. The arbe, the locust, is a description of reality. And it's coming to address a question that we didn't know we had. But this is the question that we're going to look at. So to back up a moment, we understand that the 10 plagues, in general, were punishments for the Egyptians, and they were what is called a refuah for the Jewish people. They were a healing for the Jewish people. the seven plagues that were in the parsha beforehand were seven emotional qualities, and we've talked about them before: Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, all the seven Sfirot. And the three final ones are intellectual healing. So it's like, what's intellectual healing? It means to address intellectual challenges and issues that interfere with our service of God. So it's like, so what is it that the locust comes to address? Says, we have a very fundamental challenge and problem when we look at creation. We have the idea, which we talk about and say all the time in our davening, it's a premise of Judaism, premise of Torah, is Ein od milvado. There is nothing other than God. God's presence fills all of creation. So what's the problem with that?
What are we?
Okay, clearly there is something that is not God, because God created us, and we are not God. Okay, now there's some beliefs that say, yes, we are God. It's like, I did not create myself. Okay, we are not God. And yet we say that there is nothing other than God. That paradox, when before creation there was nothing other than God, but then there had to be a creation. And so we have this idea Kabbalistically, and we kind of just say it, but we don't even know what we're talking about. It's called tzimtzum, which means a withdrawing, a contracting, a contraction, that God contracted God's self so that there would be room for us. But then by definition, we just changed that equation that said that God's presence fills everything. There's no place that's not God. So how can we have God's presence and us in the same world? It's like the locust, where the locust grows something that then becomes separate from itself, but it's still part of the locust. Do you see how we are just like the locust? Creation is just like the locust shell, in that the locust starts out as the locust, but then it grows something that is going to be separate from the locust, but is still part of the locust, because the locust walks around with it. So you wouldn't say, there's a locust and there is its shell. You would say, there's the locust. We say, here's reality. God is completely in it, and we are too. But we're not exactly part of it, God, but we have this paradox. This is the paradox that is unanswerable to us. It's not like, oh, now Ellen will tell us how this works. There is no answer to that paradox. It is beyond our comprehension.
Says, what about being B'Tselem?
So we're in the image of God, but we are not God.
Right.
Just like a shell is in the image of the locust, because it is the outline of the locust. But it's not, it's separate, but it's part of it. It's an unanswerable question. And there's lots of ways to look at it. I see God in you, like from the line from Les Mis, to love another person is to see the face of God. I love that. It's my favorite line. Beautiful idea, but it doesn't explain anything. It's a beautiful idea. It explains nothing. So in the end, we are left with this paradox that we cannot understand. It says, this is the paradox that is really at the heart of all of the questions that we have about reality that we cannot understand. We look at what we understand, what we can understand, and what we can't understand. So there are some questions that people ask where there are answers. If someone says, how come you wash hands before making hamotzi? There's an answer to that. How come, if it's a ritual thing, how come we do this? How come we do that? There are answers to all those questions. You or I may not know the answer, but there are answers. And then there are questions. This Rabbi Zakatinsky was saying that this Rav mentioned to him that somebody, he was speaking at a yeshiva, and this yeshiva boy, in between like washing for hamotzi and making hamotzi, just said to, or before washing for hamotzi, between kiddush and washing for hamotzi, said to the rabbi, I just have a quick question to ask you. And the rabbi says, okay, great. I can answer now, or we can talk later. He goes, no, you can answer now. How could God let the Holocaust happen? What? I mean, that's not a why are we washing before making hamotzi. That is a question of we don't know. We can't understand it. And there are lots of things in that. And usually if you talk to people who are having struggles with their emuna, with their faith and trust in God, and wanting to be part of the Jewish equation, where they are getting tripped up often is in these questions that have no answers. no answers that we could possibly comprehend. It's not like you'll go find some rabbi who will answer the question. There are not answers to those questions. There are not answers to the questions of how last Shabbos could seven children die in a fire on Shabbos. How did that happen? How could it be? It seems like every week we meet, there's some tragic thing for us to try to wrap our arms around. We can't even understand it. Cannot understand it. How could it be that in Har Nof that people who are davening, great rabbis who are amazing, wonderful people, could be bludgeoned and hatcheted to death after their davening? How could that happen? How could it be that three boys are coming home from yeshiva and they're abducted and shot? How could it be? How could it be that a baby dies? How could it be a plane that the co-pilot intentionally crashes a jet and kills everybody on board? How could God let that happen? We don't know. We don't know. And our answer is, we don't know, and we can't understand it. So this goes way back. It says to Moshe Rabbeinu. It says that when Moshe went up to Har Sinai to get Torah, and he was watching God write, the Torah. And that God was putting crowns, like on the letters. So if you've ever seen a Torah scroll, there's like little doohickey things on the letters. Mm-hmm. Certain letters have them. It's very precise, of course, on which ones they go on. And Moshe was like, you know, like, what are you doing that for? And God says, well, in the future, there'll be a Rabbi Akiva. And he's going to explain, he's going to darshan all sorts of halachas from these crowns. And so I'm putting them on for him. So Moshe's like, wow, somebody that great, I want to see him. So it says God shows him Rabbi Akiva, shows him teaching, and Moshe like doesn't understand even what he's saying. And he's like, wow, that's such an amazing person. I want to see what happens to him in the future. And then God shows him being tortured and murdered by the Romans. And Moshe, of course, is outraged. And he says, this is his Torah, and that's his reward? How could you let that happen, is basically what he's asking. And God says to him, shtok. What does shtok mean?
Shut up.
Normally, it's sheket. It's the command form, okay? Shtok. It's quiet. Now, if somebody says that to you now and says shtok, they mean it as shut up, okay? It's not really a very nice thing to say. But here, when it says, and I was always bothered because I had heard this before, like God's telling Moshe, like, shut up. So he follows that by saying, if this doesn't happen, I would have to undo all of creation and take it back to when it was chaos and void. Meaning, this goes to the heart of the ultimate paradox, which we don't understand anyway, which is, how can there even be a creation? Your question's on Rabbi Akiva? Your question should be on you. How are you here? How is it that I, God, fill all of reality and you are here? So this is a premise of creation. You cannot understand it. So when he says shtok, it's not mean like shut up. It means silence. There are no words. There is no explanation that I can give you. There's no explanation. This is what it is. And we have that, and that's why we say usually it's interesting. Our questions are never when something wonderful happens. We don't say, I just cannot accept the reality that this wonderful blessing has happened to me. How did this happen? We're like, thank you. I mean, we say thank you, but we don't ever wonder, like, how could this possibly have happened? We only have the question, usually, when it's something sad, tragic, horrible, that is so painful and grieves us so much that it's beyond our comprehension. So this doesn't mean that we don't get sad. It doesn't even mean we don't get mad. It just means that we will not be able to understand. It says, and this is a wonderful phrase that he said. It says, we get to a place, we have the possibility of getting to a place where the question doesn't go away from us, but we go away from the question. It's like we jump over the question. It's like, that question can't be answered, and I cannot let it be that that's going to be my barrier to being Jewish, to serving God, because no human being has the answer. That's what's called emunah. Emunah is where we jump over the question. And we say, yes, that is a question, and there are no answers, so I'm not going to beat myself up trying to find an answer. There's always a response. There's always a response to tragedy, but there is not usually an answer to it. or an explanation. It says that people who try to give explanations usually make things worse by trying to explain things. So we don't really try to do that. So when it says shtok, that's what it means, like there are no words. It can't understand. So the father of these seven children who were all killed, he basically said that. And when he spoke at their funeral, he said, in order to even bear this, all I can do is submit completely to Hashem's will. And that's not a passive submission. That is a place of gevura, of complete strength, to be able to say, God, your will is my will. There are no words. There are no words. And you move forward. Just move forward. So that is the idea of emunah. So when we think about what we understand, what we can understand, the truth is we don't really understand so much. So there's a very cute song that we sing at the Seder. It's called Who Knows One. Who knows one? I know one. One is Hashem, one is Hashem, one is Hashem, on heaven and the earth, ba-dum-ba-dum-bum. Okay, all the kids know this. It's my favorite song in English. I usually don't like English Passover songs, but that I love the song. So it's one is Hashem, two are the tablets that Moshe brought, three are the fathers, four are the mothers, five are the books of the Torah, six are the orders of the Mishnah, seven are the days of the week, eight are the days of Brit Milah, and nine are the months of pregnancy, and 10 are the commandments. 11 are the tribes of, no, 11 are the stars in Joseph's dream, and 12 are the tribes of Yisrael, and that's the song. So you say, who knows one? I know one. Now, every kid, when they're 3 years old, I know one. One is Hashem, okay? So there is the child's knowing, I know one, one is Hashem. A child, as soon as they can speak, is taught to say the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, the oneness, the unity, the unification of God. Now, does that child know and understand what that means? Do I know what that means? I'm like, I don't know what that means. What does that mean? God is all unified and there's only one unified reality. I say it, I believe it, but I don't understand it. So some people have as their mental block, I can only believe something that I can understand. It's like, well, you know, I don't even understand my toaster. So that would put me out in a bad shape. It's like, we don't say that about anything else. We do not say that about anything else. You can believe in a lot of things you don't understand. I don't understand how a child, I don't understand how a boy came out of my body. You know, like, that's so weird. Like, a girl seems kind of like somewhat natural, but like, how does a child even fit in there? Like, how did that happen? It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand it. I believe it. I know it, but I don't understand it. So when we talk about knowing, it's interesting that in this song, which is like this catchy, like simple song, we don't understand one thing on that list. Two are the tablets that Moshe brought. Okay, that's like basically the table of contents for the entire Torah. Do I really understand that? No. Do I understand how the patriarchs, how it really happened that these individuals out of a mass of humanity were able to come and emerge as believers and recognizers of God and transmit that down to where here we are today? Do I understand that? No. Do I understand equally about the mothers? No. Do I understand the five books of the Torah? No. Do I understand the six orders of the Mishnah? I can't even tell you what they are. No. Do I understand the 7 days of the week? Do I understand creation? I wasn't there. I don't understand it. Do I believe there were 7 days? Yes, I do. Are there 7 days of the week? Yes, there are. Brit Milah. Do I really understand that a circumcision, that a body that is born perfectly according to the way God designed it, needs to have something removed from it in order to give us a lesson that that's a sign of the covenant, that our life from that time on is meant about change and growth, and it has to take something away in order to grow? I understand that. I don't understand that at all. Nine are the months of pregnancy. Does anybody really understand pregnancy? No. Okay. 10 of the Ten Commandments. I understand that. The stars of Joseph's dream. That's getting a little. I don't really understand that either. And then the 12. 12 are the tribes of Israel. That the Jewish people could be divided into tribes and yet unified as a people. You'd think like all different kinds of civilizations and thoughts are always trying to bring everyone together, get rid of divisions. Why do you have to say you go under your flag, you stand here? So, wouldn't it be better to have everyone be all together? It's like, no. So do I understand that? No, actually, I don't understand. I don't understand any of that. But then we sing our song. Who knows one? I know one. One is Hashem. So we're talking about that on Pesach, we actually are bringing to our minds all the things that we don't understand. And we're asking questions about it, and we say, well, I can appreciate it, I can believe it, I can work with it, I can use it. I use my phone, I don't understand that at all. Okay, so there's a lot of things. My whole life is like that. When we start seeing how we are in the world of all the things we don't really understand, it brings us back to really being a child, where a child is always saying, why? And luckily, the questions that they ask as three-year-olds, we usually have answers to those questions. But then they get to the questions where we still have the same question. And instead of trying to think we're so grown up and mature that we can answer the question, the answer really is, you know, we just can't understand that. Hashem's mind, it says this, Hashem's thoughts are not like ours. We don't understand. We cannot understand. It says, and that is Emuna. So we talk about the Exodus. Do we really understand the fact that 3,000 years ago the Jews were redeemed from Egypt and now we're sitting here? That doesn't really make any sense whatsoever. It makes no sense. I think we've mentioned before that in military strategy training programs, evaluation, research, etc., they use military campaigns from all sorts of military strategists over the centuries, except they never use Israel, and they never use 1967. It says because it didn't make any sense. There's nothing to learn from it, because it shouldn't have worked. So what's to learn? We can't replicate that. Other strategies, military, oh, we could learn this from this, we'll learn this from that. It's like, no, that's in a different category. So we're just, the whole thing is the existence of the Jewish people is a complete mystery also. So I don't tend to think, when I get up in the morning, I don't really say to myself, wow, it's a total mystery that you are here. I don't think of my existence as a mystery, but it is. It's a total mystery. So when we sit at our table, the big question that we can't even answer is like, how come we're all sitting here? How did we all get here? And we look at where people have come from and what they've survived. It's like, how did that happen? How did this happen? Like, I don't know. And then what do? Is we say, I don't really understand any of this, but boy, am I going to celebrate. So it's the one time of year where Hallel, which are praises to God, are sung in like in the privacy of your home. You don't need to have a minion. You don't need to have anything, even if you're singing by yourself. We sing Hallel, and we sing praise to God. Like, I don't get it, but thank you so much. And the people who had the first Seder while they were still in Egypt, you know, they had suffered terribly. They had children who were killed. They themselves may have family members who died in the brutality of the Egyptians. It wasn't like all, oh, this is the group that, you know, nothing bad ever happened, so they're celebrating. It's like, no, they're celebrating with like, oh, we don't really get this. And what we really don't get is God told us just to be ready to go, and we're going to be sitting at our table eating our Passover meal of the Passover sacrifice and matzah and maror with our belts on and our staff in our hand. And God says we're leaving tomorrow. Like, I don't get how that's going to work either. So to be able to have that expression that Pesach is all about the birth of Emuna, of trust and faith in God, and that's where we go when we cannot explain or understand how things work and why things work the way they do. So this, on one hand, it's like a relief. Instead of thinking that you have to travel to some guru on the top of some mountain who's going to have the answer, we can just stay home and know there isn't an answer that we can understand. So give it up. And that is called Emuna. This doesn't mean not pursuing and trying to appreciate and understand lessons to be derived. It's called like the tam, like the flavor of it. What does it teach us? Same thing like with mitzvot that we don't understand. We ultimately don't understand kashrut. We don't understand that really at all. We can derive some lessons from it, but it's not the explanation for it. It just isn't. Yeah, we had a comedian at a Dot for our fundraiser, and he was a religious person, and he was really making fun like of Judaism and Jewish people and, you know, the different religious groups within us, etc. He said, you know, the Jewish people were just so different. So he was comparing, He said, yeah, even like our songs, and he was talking about Passover, he said, you think about like the big holiday for Christians, and they've got like the 12 nights of Christmas on the first night of Christmas, my true love gave to me, you know, a partridge and a pear tree. That's like the partridge and like all these like nice things. You get our songs like Hagadya, and we've got animal cruelty, you know, the dog that bit the cat that chased the list, and what it's like, what kind of a people? And then everyone's singing and having a good time. It's like, what are we talking about? I was like, I don't know. So, like, we are just so different. We are so different. So it's not only why is this night different from all other nights, it's really why is this people so different from all other people? It looks kind of the same when we walk around. We don't look like Martians, but we're so different. And what makes us so different in appreciating that at our Seders and on Pesach? And that is the emuna that the Jewish people, it's part of our DNA. One of the names of the Jewish people is Ivrim, from the word over, which means to cross over. It says that when we just talk about Avraham Avinu, Avraham our father, that he was, the whole world was on one side in their belief system, and he was on the other side. And it can also be used to understand this idea we talked about jumping over, going over the question, of not letting the question stop us. Because for many people, it is a blind spot, it is a barrier, it is a huge barrier. And the Jewish people were like, good point. Yes, that is a big question. I'm just going to go right over that question and just continue on. And that we are the Ivrim, that we go over that and just continue on. When we talk about, when we talk about the other, with the answers, we say that there are answers. Tomorrow, Machar, God will send the locust for us to understand. Luckily, we don't have locusts as part of our Seder. We have Kos Eliyahu. We have Elijah's cup. And Elijah's cup, and we always say Tiku. We always say that the Eliyahu HaTishbi will come and answer the questions. So that in the future, all these questions will be answered. So there are descriptions that say, in this world, there are no answers. And in the world to come, there will be no questions. They will be able to see the whole thing. So save your question. Sometimes like a teacher will say, save your question for later. And then often they hope that maybe you'll forget that you had that question because they don't really have an answer to it. But save your question for Eliyahu. So we say there are answers. We just can't know them yet. And so we put Eliyahu's cup on the Seder table. And it's like almost like we pour our questions in there. You could even have that. This just came to my mind that anytime someone has a question at the Seder about how could God do whatever, it's like, you know what? Let's just pour that in Eliyahu's cup and he'll answer that when he comes. That's a good question for Eliyahu to answer. We'll take it to the top in the future when that will be able to be answered. And it's a big cup. So in the vernacular, I think in Israel, like when there is a tie in a soccer game, what do they say? Tiku?
Teiko.
Which is the same thing. That's an acronym. They don't know they're saying a religious thing that is quoted in the Talmud that stands for Eliyahu HaTishbi will come and he will answer the question. That's what it means. That Eliyahu, in case you thought that was a real burning question of who really won the tie in the soccer game, Eliyahu will answer that question in the future. So all things that are not resolvable by us now are in the future, they will be answered. All of our questions.
Is it an acronym?
Yes. Tishbi, so it's spelled Tishbi Yavo, the something, the Oneha Kushio, the questions. So it's so funny because I'm guessing that the soccer games are not exactly a bastion of religious thought, but they're basically saying Eliyahu is going to answer this question for us in the future, and then you can go ahead, and you also then don't have to like kill each other because you know Eliyahu will answer that question in the future. Okay. This says that there's nothing that gives a person more sense of yeshivas hadas, which means basically a settled mind, than having doubts resolved. Having doubts resolved makes people feel at ease. And then there are some things that also is to take something off your plate to not have to address. And it doesn't mean that you have, you know, caved in, or that you've just, you know, let go of your intellectual, responsibility for understanding things. It's just saying, this isn't in my realm. As people say, I like people say, this is above my pay grade. You know, it's above my pay grade. It's not for me to answer. So in comforting mourners. So it's also very important. It's one of the reasons why we don't say anything. It's like, what are you going to say? It's just be there. We have a response. We just don't have an answer. And those two things are different. We're just there, absorbing their pain and helping and being responsive to them as mourners. But there's nothing that we can say that explains it away. So this is our idea of Pesach, that we're putting all these things here. The other part of Pesach that is so interesting is if you are going to, we are obligated to tell the story. We're supposed to talk about the Exodus. We're supposed to talk about that. This part is called the Magid, from the word Haggadah. You shall tell your children in the future. So it's so interesting. If you open any Haggadah, the verses that are in the Haggadah that we say, where would you expect them to be from?
Exodus.
You would expect them to be from Exodus. Okay, that's where the story is. It takes like a lot. There's a lot of column inches. Just pick your paragraph that you want to talk about.
Nothing.
You would expect that it would be from Exodus.
No Moshe.
There's no Moshe, and there is no Exodus either. Okay, because instead what we're going to do, and we talked about this last year, but we want to go to the page 1069. So we're in the part of Torah. Page 1069. So which book of Torah are we in?
Deuteronomy.
Whose words are Deuteronomy?
Moshe's
words. Okay? Moshe's words. The other four books of the Torah are God's words dictated to Moshe that he wrote down. The book of Devarim, of Deuteronomy, are Moshe's words that God authorized, approved for Moshe to write down to include in the Torah. It says that Moshe and God were so much on the same page, and there was such unity of vision. It says even though they were Moshe's words, they were God's words too. But we said they're Moshe's words. So that's already interesting. Moshe's words are in this. This is his. These are his words. And he's talking about, and what's it say in the paragraph on the sidebar there where it says next to chapter 26? First fruits. It's like, what does that have to do with anything? This is the paragraph that is in, starting with verse 5 through 10. It says, this is the paragraph that is in the Haggadah. So it starts out with, then you shall call out and say before Hashem, your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather. He descended to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. And not only are these verses in the Haggadah, but a traditional Haggadah is going to have like a page of commentary on each phrase within this section of the Torah. This is called the Vidui. This is called the confession or the acknowledgement of bringing first fruits. Why is this in the Haggadah when it does not have anything to do, apparently, with the Exodus? Let's read the rest of it so that we can see. So it's when you bring your first fruits. This is what you're going to bring this. So Joan, do you want to go ahead on verse 5? Janice.
Keep going.
Janice.
Then you shall call out and say before Hashem your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather. He descended to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. There he became a nation, great, strong, and numerous. The Egyptians mistreated us and afflicted us and placed hard work upon us. And we cried out to Hashem, the God of our forefathers, and Hashem heard our voice and saw our affliction, our travail, and our oppression. Hashem took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm, with great awesomeness, with signs and with wonders. He brought us to this place and he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now behold, I have brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given me, O Hashem. And you shall lay it before Hashem your God, and you shall prostrate yourself before Hashem your God.
Okay, so what is this little paragraph here?
It's a summary.
It's a summary. And it takes it back to an Aramean trying to destroy my forefather, meaning Laban, trying to destroy Yaakov by messing around with the wives and wanting to kill him and all of these things. And so it starts, well, I mean, that's not that it has anything to do with the Exodus. That's way, way before the Exodus. That's way before the Jewish people went into Egypt. This is way, way before. But this is now, and it's taking it all the way until they get into the land of Israel. So this summary is not only a summary, it's tying, connecting all the dots of history. It's taking it from, like, this is how things started, then it went here in enslavement, and then we were redeemed, and they're bringing us to the land of Israel. And Moshe, who's not even living to this time, is already seeing in prophecy, and you will do this when you get there, and you will say this, and you'll say, and now these first fruits, this is the fruit, this is what's the result after going through that whole experience. In a way, focusing just on the Exodus from Egypt is an understatement. It's a misrepresentation of what we're really celebrating. Yes, we're celebrating the Exodus from Egypt, but what we're really doing is putting it into a much larger context of, let's talk about how things really started and where things are really going, so we have a fuller appreciation and can comprehend a bigger picture. And Moshe himself is fulfilling the mitzvah, which is that in the Torah it says, and you shall explain to your children. Because who is Moshe talking to now? This is, in Deuteronomy, this is the last month of his life, which means it's after the 40 years. So who is he talking to? The next generation. He himself is fulfilling the commandment. This is what we're doing at the Seder. We don't need the eyewitness account of it. We don't need God's words describing it, which is the book of Shemot, that's God's words describing the Exodus. We need what we're supposed to be doing, which is, here's a parent who is doing exactly what the commandment says, which is, you shall explain to your children. He's explaining to people who did not live through that, or were too young and don't remember it. So he's telling them, and he's giving them the story and putting it in a large context. This is direction for us of exactly what we're supposed to be doing, and to include ourselves, which means that when at our Seders, when we can broaden the picture and talk about then what's next, and what's our family's history, how are we, if we were expanding this paragraph, how are we? Where did our ancestors come from? And then the Jews, we know that we have a common common ancestry to the exile. And then we have families that went to Spain, and families that went to Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and then the Holocaust and the pogroms, and then they came to Ellis Island, or they went to Israel and they came here. And who are we in this story? If we're not in the story, then we haven't fulfilled the directions. I'm in this story. So when it says to see yourself as if you were liberated, means see yourself as part of your family history. We're the descendants of those people. If we don't see ourselves as having that be part of our story, and look, it's so interesting. People spend so much money and time doing research now into their ancestry. Ancestry.com, this.com, find this person, find that person. It's like, people, we've got the biggest Ancestry.com right here. We know our history. We know our history. It's amazing. We know exactly what happened. We might be missing a few years in there, but fill it in. Bring ourselves back into the connection so that we know this is us. We were freed from Egypt, because if this didn't happen, we wouldn't be sitting here. We would be gone. So this is my history. If I can't see myself in there, then I've missed the whole point. Moshe is fulfilling that by saying, this is you. Because you know how it is, the next generation. I remember, it only was when I became an adult that I realized how close the Holocaust happened to my life. I was born in 1956. It wasn't that far away. But as a kid, dinosaurs, the expulsion, and the Holocaust were kind of like all in the same picture before me. Okay? It was before me, so it's like all the same. It's only as we get older that we realize, wow, this actually wasn't that long ago. In fact, all of this really wasn't actually that long ago. There have only been, I think it's now maybe 35 Passover experiences. I share this every year because I find it so fascinating. And this is Beryl Wine. Rabbi Beryl Wine always talks about this, that if we take, and now I didn't bring this because I wasn't planning to say this, the year of the Exodus, which was, I don't know, was it year 2000 something? Abraham was born in the Jewish year 1948. So whatever it was, somebody can look on their phone or have it, however many years it's been, if you take, instead of a generation, you take a Seder experience of a lifetime of, from me when I was a baby being at my great-grandmother's Seder. And now, God willing, I'll be a great-grandmother. And so I'll be a person who has in common, like all of these different Seders. That's a very long period of time. Let's say 80 years. Let's call it an 80-year experience. You take, let's take, just for the sake of it, let's say 3,200 years. You take 3,200 years divided by 80. What is that? Try again. 40. Wow. There have only been 40 unique, completely new group of people. Nobody was ever connected to one person or the other, Seder units since the Exodus from Egypt. That's not very many. I can't believe I've been making Seder already for 30 years in my own house. That's really weird, because in my mind, guess how it appears? All blurred into one Passover experience. Like, the truth is, it was just one experience spread out kind of over in slow motion, kind of like when you see a movie and then they slow it down and it makes it appear like things are happening very slowly, but then you see it go and actually it goes quickly. That's really what's happening. It's like God spread it out over all these years, but it's really just one Seder experience, because I have very clear memories. That's my memories from being at my great-grandmother's Seder. And God willing, I'll have a chance to be a great-grandmother at the other end. And like, yeah, that is from my great-grandmother to my great-grandchildren, God willing, that's one Seder experience. Wow. That's amazing. It says it really was not so long ago. If we can't place ourselves in that story, in that history, then we have not fulfilled our obligation to say, this is my home, our family, and this is my history. It's not those other people, it's us. And we don't understand it. So when we start singing that song, to keep in mind, who knows one? Oh, I know one. One is Hashem, two are the tablets, three are the fathers, four are the mothers, etc. It's like, we believe it, and we know it, but we don't understand it. And to be able to differentiate those two. I know it, but I don't understand it. God willing, we'll have a wonderful, wonderful, happy, healthy, kosher Pesach, and transmitting the joy of our heritage to all those who are with us. We will not meet next week, and we will not meet during the week of Pesach. So we will see you after the following week. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday.
Not next week.
Or the following week.
So just to add something before you leave, there is an argument that